U.S. government and the Biden administration really need to come to their own internal sense of the purpose of this decoupling and a long-term vision for success.
Welcome back to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs, the entirely student-run podcast at Johns Hopkins University. I'm your host, Julia Ahn. In recent years, growing tensions between the U.S. and China have spurred increasing interest and action to decouple the U.S. and China's economic and technological ecosystems. This is evident in the increased use of technological restrictions, from export controls to sanctions and visa bans. And while there appears to be bipartisan support for technological decoupling in general, an exact strategy and course of action are yet to be defined. So which technologies should be controlled, and to what degree? How can the U.S. define a clear strategy to curb technological interdependence with China while avoiding the pitfalls of doing too much or too little? In this episode, I'm joined by Mr. John Bateman to answer these questions. John Bateman is a senior fellow at the Cyber Policy Initiative of the Technology and International Affairs Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Previously, John has served as Director for Cyber Strategy Implementation in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. He's recently published the report, U.S.-China Technological Decoupling, a Strategy and Policy Framework. We hope you enjoy today's episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. John, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Great being here with you.
To start our conversation and kind of to frame it, I would like to ask if you could begin by giving us an overview of how U.S. and Chinese tech ecosystems have evolved in the recent years, and how have they become coupled?
Well, that's a great starting point. What's the baseline of coupling prior to this wave of decoupling that we've been experiencing for a few years now? So most of your listeners will know that for several decades, the U.S. and China became more and more economically enmeshed. And this was a conscious policy of the U.S. government and the Chinese government, and lots of private sector companies were involved, and third countries whose governments and companies are involved in various supply chains also took part in this overall economic coupling. We've become particularly interdependent on one another in the technological arena. And I'll roll through some examples. If you think about U.S. technology products like the iPhone, the iPhone is manufactured in China, designed in California. So that's an example of the interdependence of the two countries in the product arena. You can dig beneath that to look at the components that technology products are built upon. That would include components like rare earth materials, which are overwhelmingly sourced from China in their processed form. Or a polysilicon that's used for solar panels. Those largely come from China today. You could then dig beneath the component level and think about the people whose intellectual property and know-how create new innovations. This is the STEM talent pipeline that the U.S. Relies in part on foreigners and China and India as the top two. So many, many PhDs at places like Johns Hopkins and other universities in STEM fields come from China, and the stay rate is very high. So many of those people stay on in the United States following their initial research and work for major U.S. tech companies. So those are just some of the ways in which the U.S. has become reliant on China as a supplier, a manufacturing hub, a technological partner. Now, of course, China is also other things to the United States. It's a stealer of intellectual property. It's a strategic and military competitor. It's a human rights abuser using technology. So it's a complicated picture. I would just wrap up by saying that China is similarly dependent on the U.S. for money, for technology cooperation, and for many parts of its supply chain, like semiconductors.
And I guess for our listeners who aren't as well versed in the area, is there any kind of like quantitative way that we can use to measure the level of U.S.-China dependency, and especially in the tech sphere, as that's the topic for today? Or does it just depend on evaluating where the U.S. uses Chinese labor or intellectual property and things like that?
Yeah, so at a macro level, if you're thinking about technological interdependence, you could look at large statistics like the flow of students and researchers, the numbers of visas granted. You could look at the financial arena, the amount of foreign direct investment, venture capital investment, passive investment, active greenfield investment going to and from the two countries. You could look at a number of other metrics, exports, imports of certain categories of technology goods, and you'll find a mixed picture in many of these areas. Generally, the picture has been of decades of growing interdependence, followed by a recent wave in the last, say, 5 to 7 years of a partial technological decoupling.
Right. And I think that's a perfect segue to what I wanted to ask you about next, which is, when did U.S. interest in technological decoupling begin, which you talked about was in the last few years? And I wondered, what occurred during this period that maybe caused Americans and lawmakers to reevaluate their views? And was it just things that happened between the U.S.-Chinese relationship, or were other factors involved?
U.S. leaders and policymakers' interest in technological decoupling with China grew very, very slowly and then very, very rapidly. The slow period is during the 90s and 2000s, when the rough, albeit imperfect, DC consensus was that greater integration with China was a net win for the United States and could help change China, benefit the U.S. economy. It was really in the late Obama administration that this consensus started to crumble and eventually dissipate. And there were a couple reasons for this. One is changes in Chinese behavior that really led to much darker views of China in Washington. So well-known examples include China's militarization of the South China Sea, its growing authoritarianism under President Xi, and the dawning reality that China was not liberalizing, but it would in fact have deepening authoritarianism. The revelations of the abhorrent repression of the Uyghur population in Xinjiang, the growing saber rattling against Taiwan, the encroachments on Hong Kong, and the ultimate destruction of the one country, two systems model. The military buildup that the PLA was undertaking, much of this or some of this through exploitation of links to the West. And also, very importantly, the continued theft of intellectual property and other forms of either technology-enabled or non-technology-enabled unfair trade practices from China, which had always been a problem, but which now was actually helping China move up the economic value chain to the point where China could challenge the United States and the West in some particularly important emerging technologies. So that's factor number one, the darkening views of China. Factor number two is the ascendance of what's called techno-nationalism. Techno-nationalism is the view that technology is too strategically important to the life and death of countries to be left to the marketplace or private markets. But rather, technology is an arena of strategic competition in which states must guide and protect their tech industries, economies, and national security. This was pretty much a growing idea around the world, and the United States was one of the last countries to come to a techno-nationalist point of view, again, in the kind of 2010s, 2020s. The reason for this is that the U.S. had largely benefited from a globalized vision of the spread of technology. It benefited in its national security. It benefited in its economy. We were the leading technology producer in many arenas. But gradually, we started to see ourselves as more vulnerable, and we can describe many of the incidents that occurred there, the theft of intellectual property, Russia's influence in the 2016 election, and on and on. So together, the darkening views of China and Washington's late coming embrace of techno-nationalism has created a new American techno-nationalism that's focused principally on China. And the net result of this is a desire in Washington to partially decouple from China's technology.
And before we talk more about how we've been decoupling and what are the solutions, I did want to ask you, since I know there seems to be a lot of different types of tools that the U.S. can use to restrict individuals and companies. I know the specially designated nationals is something that's talked about a lot, as that's sanctioning, but there are also other lists like the entity list, and these can get categorized as well, or strategies can get categorized as offensive or defensive. And so I wondered, to also frame our discussion, if you could give our listeners maybe an overview of the financial penalties or strategies mm-hmm. that Washington has at its to employ.
Absolutely. So a simple way that sometimes people describe the policy tools that are available is in this defensive bucket and in an offensive bucket. So defense would be the U.S. government seeking to protect itself from Chinese predation or exploitation. Often defense involves seeking to forcefully sever links with China to somehow reduce Chinese technological influence, thwart or slow Chinese technological progress, and so on. So examples of defensive policies would be export controls, import controls like tariffs, investment restrictions, like the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States that screens investments for national security concerns. We've already talked about visas. So visas of Chinese nationals can be restricted going to universities or for work. There's also a lot of licensing and authorization that the federal government does to allow or not allow a Chinese or other foreign company to operate a telecommunications carrier, build a submarine cable that lands inside the United States, sell equipment that uses radio frequencies on American spectrum. Then you mentioned financial sanctions like the SDN list, and there's a range of financial sanctions that can be used to blacklist or punish, basically blocking entities or individuals from access to financial markets that touch the United States. We've got a variety of technology-specific rules. The U.S. government also restricts its own use by federal agencies of Chinese and other foreign technology, and it restricts how its money, whether it's going to federal contractors or grantees, is used. And there's also law enforcement actions like prosecutions, investigations, including those under the now mothballed China Initiative. So that's just a broad overview of the defensive tools available to Washington. We can go into them at length, and the quick version of it is that all of these defensive tools have been greatly expanded and intensified against China. Just to quickly add on to that, the whole second bucket is offense. So offense would be kind of running faster, self-improvement, investing in America's own technological strength, resilience, and competitiveness. So this would be things like spending money on research and development, improving the education system, reforming regulations, investing in supply chain resilience. There are many things in that offensive bucket, but a lot of the attention in the last few years has really been on defense, which I think has been imbalanced.
And kind of going forward with that point, I wondered, now that we have a better idea of the tools in mind, what has seemingly been the U.S.'s strategy or policy towards initiating this decoupling that we've seen in the last decade?
So the U.S. doesn't have an explicit, declared, clear, principled strategy for technological decoupling. There is no published document that outlines the U.S. vision for technological decoupling with China. What we have instead are a number of different actions, like those defensive and offensive tools that I've been describing, from which we can seek to derive a sense of U.S. strategy. And we also have statements by government officials that have become increasingly assertive toward China over time, but don't necessarily clarify some of the key dilemmas. And just to explain the lack of a strategy with reference to what a strategy would actually look like, a real U.S. strategy would need to ultimately describe what kind of technology relationship we do in fact want to have with China, and where we draw the line between those sensitive strategic technologies where we have a national security or economic interest in some manner of partial decoupling, and those non-strategic, non-sensitive areas where we might wish to continue and even expand and deepen technological cooperation with China. We need a strategy in America that articulates stopping points and objectives to explain the relationship between things like our desire to maintain a military edge over the People's Liberation Army on the one hand, and our desire to have access to the Chinese market for our own companies on the other hand. How can we make these two things work together? Or likewise, when you get into the human rights issue, is it US policy to have a sweeping campaign to restrict and crush or destroy technology companies that are involved in China's mass surveillance within its own country? Or do we draw the line at China's export of that mass surveillance to other countries? Or is it neither of those things, and we're primarily focused on the worst human rights abuses, those in Xinjiang leading to crimes against humanity against China's Uyghur population? There's a whole stew of kind of confused objectives, trade-offs, and dilemmas that the U.S. really hasn't faced up to in an explicit way. And that's what's been missing from policy discourse in the last few years and why I wrote this report.
Right. And before we delve into it, I also just wanted to ask quickly, what are the views on decoupling or technological decoupling from China and from our allies and other governments and maybe private entities?
Well, it's a really, really important question, and a question that's actually not asked frequently enough in Washington. And let me say, I'm not a China expert. But my sense from what I see and read of China is that China believes that it largely benefits from its current technological links to the United States and the West, although it wants to move more gradually to a position of self-sufficiency and global market share dominance in key strategic technology industries. China recognizes that it's not at that point today, and so it wants to continue to draw upon the intellectual, financial, personnel, and other resources that the United States and the West can provide to China. So what we've generally seen China do is respond or react to US restrictions or decoupling policies in a fairly reciprocal, somewhat cautious, moderated manner, just to show that it will do so, but in an effort not to escalate. So for example, the US has been using this thing that we've described called the entity list. It's essentially a company-specific sanction that prevents certain Chinese companies from importing US goods without a license. It's a form of export control. And as the US has drastically ramped up its use of the entity list, actually quadrupling the number of Chinese companies and entities that are on this list in just 4 years, China responded by creating its own list called the Unreliable Entity List. But China's list is a bit more ambiguous, and it hasn't made any publicly declared designations under this list, whereas the US has made hundreds of designations under the US version of it. So that's an example of how China is trying to fight back, but in a way that's non-escalatory. Now, my fear is that China is gradually concluding that the US plans harsher measures over time than it's undertaken to date. And therefore, China will intensify its interests in its own decoupling measures. That could ultimately make the US government lose control of the decoupling process and create a kind of runaway cycle that goes faster, farther, or in a more chaotic manner than America really wants, intends, or perhaps can afford. And ultimately, the same is true of other governments and private institutions around the world. Few of them have been as aggressive in promoting technological decoupling with China as the United States has. A lot of them have gone along with various levels of interest or reluctance, but never as forcefully, never as the lead actor. But again, as expectations of further decoupling calcify and become, deeper than they already are, we could see preemptive action by global private companies and third country governments to make decoupling a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And in a report that you mentioned that you recently wrote, released by the Carnegie Endowment, you do outline kind of three categories that can be used to group strategies or options for technological decoupling. And those are restrictionist, a cooperationist, and a centrist camp. And I thought this was a really interesting way to group these strategies and solutions. So I wondered if you could first just elaborate on them for our audience.
Yeah, so I group proposed U.S. strategies into three camps. And just a caveat, these are crude generalizations, and these are my terms. So other people out there with these strategic ideas might or might not agree that they belong in one of these camps. And all of the camps have porous boundaries and are flexible. But let's just say that on one end of the spectrum are those that I call the restrictionists. And the key restrictionist belief is that the U.S.-China technology relationship is a zero-sum relationship, and it generally tends to advantage China. So restrictionists often believe that the U.S. is gaining these kinds of transitory, insignificant benefits like access to cheaper products from China or a short-term shareholder value from exports to China. But what China is gaining are these deeper strategic advantages like advancing itself in the technologies of the future and placing itself in the position where it could ultimately dominate and freeze out the United States. So what restrictionists then believe is that the U.S. has a short window of opportunity to prevent Chinese technological dominance. And during this window, it's critical for the United States to greatly expand the technology restrictions aimed at China. So you might expect a lot of Chinese China hawks in the United States are restrictionists, and national security officials have some restrictionist leanings. We also see restrictionist ideas from the human rights community. So, for example, Human Rights Watch has been calling for global Magnitsky Act sanctions against a large number of Chinese tech companies, potentially. Now, at the other end of the spectrum are those that I call cooperationists. Cooperationists believe that the U.S.-China technology relationship is largely non-zero-sum, or at least that whatever it is, it tends to benefit the United States more so than China, or just a great deal. So cooperationists worry that Americans kind of inflate China-related technology threats and that major technology restrictions could be harmful to the United States, crippling our own innovators, crippling our own industries, freezing us out of technology supply chains and competition. It could also be internationally destabilizing as we disrupt or aggravate bilateral tensions, could make it harder to cooperate on global issues. Cooperationists include, obviously, many in the business community. Also, the kind of old school techno-globalist activists who just believe in a borderless internet. And I also describe some progressives like Bernie Sanders that are really worried about this securitization of the technology and the broader relationship. Now, let me just say that restrictionists have gained a lot of influence in recent years, whereas cooperationists have lost a lot of influence. So the real debate is between restrictionists at one end and what I describe as a middle camp, the centrist camp. Now, this camp takes a more complicated view of the bilateral technology relationship. Centrists, and I count myself as one, think that there's a non-zero-sum and zero-sum elements of the relationship. There's mixed costs and benefits for the United States and China. So generally, centrists are comfortable with the amount of decoupling that's happened so far. They may have small critiques about implementation. But the key thing is that they believe that future restrictions need to be narrowly tailored, targeted, and carefully thought through. That it should be a small yard with a high fence around it. That new restrictions should be multilateral and coordinated with our allies, and that they should also be complemented by a huge primary offensive investment in U.S. technological strength. There's quite a few centrists in the mainstream D.C. tech think tank community, which is where I'm from. You also have some moderate political figures like Chris Coons and state and local leaders that are more in the centrist camp.
And I remember reading one interesting thing that was in your report when you were talking about the centrist camp is, I guess, a key part is making an effort on the offensive side to maybe invest in U.S. diverse innovation pathways and supply chains and being more strategic, like you kind of talked about using the defensive restrictions and only in areas maybe where China is close to achieving breakthroughs to buy time while our offensive strategy pays off. First, is this a correct characterization of a key part of this this camp?
So you've hit on one of my key arguments in the report, which is that we're in a moment of uncertainty and flux in so many different arenas, in the U.S.-China relationship writ large, in global history, rise of this kind of geotechnological competition, the emergence of new technologies like machine learning and quantum computing, whose geopolitical and geoeconomic consequences are very difficult to predict. And we've got this big debate about what all of this means. And so my argument is that the best US strategy would essentially hedge. We wouldn't decide now what degree of technological decoupling is necessary between the US and China. But instead, we'd try to prepare for a variety of different scenarios, depending on what comes next, and seek to preserve and expand our options in that time. So as you said, the primary effort would be offensive. We would be investing in ourselves. An example of this would be the bills under consideration in China to incentivize semiconductor fabrication within the United States, bolster research and development in key areas, bolster supply chain resilience and security, improve our education system, and the like. This really is crucial because ultimately the United States has a lot more control over its own technological trajectory than it does about China or any other country. So these could be very, very meaningful investments that could both help the United States in the present reality where we're still in a semi-globalized technology marketplace. These are investments that could make the US more competitive. But at the same time, if we decide later that a more fulsome technological decoupling is necessary for US security, these investments could reduce US dependence on China to the point where that kind of decoupling becomes feasible and with lower costs and risks. At the same time, these offensive investments are fairly difficult to implement and time consuming. So we need to buy time, extend our runway for these things to pay off, and in the meantime, focus on preventing China from somehow securing a position of long-term entrenched dominance in any strategically important technology. And that's where these defensive measures come in. They can be a secondary effort to temporarily slow or thwart Chinese progress or influence in key areas. But they can really only be that. They can't actually stop China. And they also come with a ton of costs and risks for US interests. So it's critical to only use them in very narrow cases where there's a compelling justification and we've thought through the second and third order consequences. If we do that, then those defensive measures can buy the United States time for offensive measures to pay off, and in the meantime, create space to assess these evolving geopolitical and geoeconomic circumstances to decide what comes next.
I know some listeners, after hearing that, may be wondering, if we limit our defensive tactics, especially in areas where China may be a lot more advanced than us, they may be concerned about the feasibility of whether or not this would buy us enough time to, say, catch up. Is this a valid concern?
I guess the way I would answer that question is we need to think about what these tools can really buy us. So you asked about an area where China is demonstrably ahead of the United States already. An example of this would be in commercial drone technology. The Chinese company DJI is the unquestioned global leader of commercial drones. It has the world-beating technology in this category and is the most cost-competitive of any of its competitors. It has probably 80% roughly global market share, US market share. So this is an area where China is well ahead, and the US really needs to work hard to catch up. And it's a big concern that there really isn't any non-Chinese alternative that is cost and technology competitive to China. Now, let's say we decided to impose harsh defensive measures on China to slow DJI's progress and give us a chance to catch up. We've imposed a few already. We've imposed the entity list designation and something that's called the non-SDN CMIC list. And I won't even spell that out for you. But basically, these lists prevent DJI from importing US technology or receiving US financial investments. Now, it happens that doesn't really make that much of a difference. DJI is largely sufficient in terms of its own Chinese investment flow, and it doesn't rely on the United States for subcomponents. So some people, like one of the Republican chairmen of the FCC, have called for taking harsher actions against DJI, like placing them on the FCC's covered list. Now, this would be a huge escalation in that it would lead eventually to DJI's banishment from the U.S. market. DJI would not be able to get authorization from the FCC to sell any new product that doesn't already exist today within the United States. So what would happen if we did that? Yes, you could argue that that would create space for a U.S. alternative to get more market share. But there really isn't a U.S. alternative that can compete on a pound-for-pound basis with DJI. So it would really create a void that would essentially cause U.S. adoption of drone technology to really be stifled. So now we're thinking about impacts on U.S. law enforcement, U.S. local government, U.S. farms, U.S. businesses, Amazon, other, new uses of drone technology. So we would be entering a several year period and perhaps longer where the costs would rise and the capabilities would decrease. So my argument is it would make no sense to put DJI on the covered list today. We need to work harder to develop our own domestic or allied alternative to DJI. And that point is then when we could consider whether a harsh sanction like placement on the covered list is actually beneficial for the United States or not. But today, it's clearly not.
And I guess another key aspect of your argument or the centrist argument that I read seems to be the emphasis on ensuring that restrictions or I guess a defensive strategy when used are used more precisely and in a more targeted way. Now, for people such as myself who are not as well versed in the field, I wanted to ask, what does it mean to be more targeted or precise from a policy standpoint?
So it can mean a few different things. One thing it can mean is really picking our battles and using these tools when we have a compelling case and we're prepared to accept the consequences. So, for example, very recently, it was reported that the Biden administration is considering placing a Chinese company called Hikvision on the SDN list. Now, Hikvision is one of the global leaders of surveillance equipment. It's a very recognized global brand. It sells cameras and surveillance systems in more than 180 companies. And the U.S. has actually never used the SDN list against a Chinese company like that before. The SDN list is the harshest financial sanction that the U.S. has. It's often used for terrorist leaders, drug lords, tyrants, and war criminals. So placement on the SDN list would be a huge escalation that would very much halt Hikvision's operations in many countries around the world, almost certainly lead China to retaliate against similar U.S. companies, and entrench this global expectation that more similar sanctions like that are probably on their way. And therefore, private companies should go ahead and unwind long-term commitments that could rely on U.S. technology or U.S. Chinese technology or U.S.-China technological cooperation. So that would be an example of what I would call a non-targeted sanction, because it's really not getting us anything. It's not going to change Chinese behavior for the underlying problem, which is Hikvision's support to Chinese surveillance in Xinjiang. But it would cause a huge escalation. So that's one kind of non-targeted measure. The other kind of non-targeted measure is when we're really just vague about creating a new restrictive authority. So this would include something called the ICTS supply chain security rule that the Commerce Department now administers. It's a sweeping new authority that allows the federal government to review and potentially block almost any large-scale use of Chinese technology in the United States. Now, we haven't really been very clear about how we plan to use this authority, and it hasn't yet been used in the year plus that it's been in effect. But there are several somewhat secretive investigations going on, and it's anyone's guess how enforcement actions under this new authority will help define the U.S.-China technology relationship in the future. So it troubles me that we create these sweeping new authorities and are rather coy about how we in fact plan to use them over time. I think it would be much better for Congress and the administration to spell out in plain English the narrow circumstances and clear criteria under which we'd use an authority like that, so that we can stabilize global expectations and prevent the United States from losing control of the technology decoupling process.
And on that note, as the United States continues to clarify its position and ultimately define a strategy for decoupling, what would you say, or how would you outline maybe the key objectives that the U.S. should have in mind when approaching decoupling?
So that's a really important question, because I think the United States has so many different and interrelated concerns about Chinese technology, most of them very valid and legitimate, that they tend to kind of fuse together in this just melange of undifferentiated China tech threats. And so you'll hear people in Washington, D.C. sometimes talk rather loosely about countering Chinese tech or reining in Chinese tech or decoupling from China. And what I argue is it's critically important to define more discrete objectives that the U.S. is pursuing with reference to China, but ultimately with reference to U.S. national security and economic interests. So I outline a number of these in my report, and I'll rattle off a few of you now. In the national security arena, we need to maintain a military edge over China. The United States needs to limit Chinese national security espionage. We need to prevent Chinese sabotage in a crisis. We also need to limit Chinese influence operations. And in some cases, try to deny support for or reduce our complicity with China-enabled authoritarianism and repression that leverages technology. So those are five different national security objectives. Each of them is actually rather distinct and comes with different trade-offs and dilemmas. Then we've got a couple economic objectives. One of these is countering unfair Chinese economic practices. So that would include IP theft, subsidies, discriminatory licensing and regulation, market access barriers. Then the next objective would be to actually compete and lead in strategic industries, irrespective of whether that competition with China is fair or unfair. Now, unfortunately, policymakers sometimes confuse these two objectives. They think that somehow if we were to stop or thwart all Chinese unfair practices, we would therefore obviously lead in all of the strategic industries. And it's not so simple. We actually need to understand that these are two different things, and that in some cases, actions that we take to better ourselves in key industries could themselves be considered unfair economic practices under prevailing rules. And then finally, I lay out two what I call ancillary objectives. These are things that are not necessarily about technology per se. So for example, the U.S. sometimes seeks to use these tools to obtain general leverage over China. Trump actually described the use of the entity list designations of Huawei and ZTE as chips that he could use in trade talks with Beijing, and that he sought to either bargain away or build goodwill for deals that had nothing to do with China technology primarily, but had more ultimately to do with agricultural products, access for U.S. financial firms to Chinese markets. And then the final ancillary objective, which you know is generally not a very good focus for U.S. policy, is shaping the U.S. domestic narrative. So these are things like Trump imposing these harsh restrictions on TikTok, possibly for self-serving political reasons, not necessarily because of a responsible, careful analysis of TikTok's threat to U.S. national security.
And finally, to end our podcast on a look towards the future, what would you say are the key steps right now that the U.S. government should take in order to ensure that this decoupling process that the U.S. is in for U.S.-China tech is responsible and avoids the risks that some of which that you just outlined?
So there are key steps the United States needs to take on a strategy level and on a policy level. On a strategy level, which is where we really need to start, the U.S. government and the Biden administration really need to come to their own internal sense of the purpose of this decoupling and a long-term vision for success. I think the best way to frame this question is, what is the nature of the technology relationship that the United States actually wants to have with China? Is that a totalized decoupling? Is that some form of managed interdependence? And with that vision, then start identifying principled objectives, standards, and stopping points or limiting principles in each of the areas that we've described today. Then that strategy needs to be publicly articulated in some way. We need a real fulsome, clear, and compelling explanation of the US strategy in a way that actually has persuasive power to key global audiences, whether that's people in Beijing, whether that's Chinese tech companies, US tech companies, the global investment community, third country governments, allies, partners, and others. By taking those steps, if the US government could succeed, that could help place America on a path toward a responsible, careful, prudent technological decoupling that doesn't run out of control, that doesn't create costly self-harm and cut off America's nose despite its face. Now, once that strategy is in place, the next step is to make sure that US policy actually fits that strategy. So the most important step the government can take right now is to pass some version of the two bills that the House and Senate have passed recently related to China tech competition. In the House, the America Competes Act, and in the Senate, the US Innovation and Competition Act. These represent the shift toward offense. These bills offer tens of billions of dollars for supply chain security, reshoring of semiconductor manufacturing, R&D, and more. Now, these bills are not without their flaws, and I know lots of people have concern with different parts of them. But at a broad stroke, that's the kind of mental shift that the United States needs, a down payment on offense and investing in running faster and in US technological strength. The final policy piece is to then start circumscribing and clarifying some of these key restrictive or defensive measures that aren't very clear today. That includes things like the ICTS supply chain regulation. Clarify that, narrow it. That includes some of the use of human rights related authorities to sanction or restrict Chinese companies. We need to define what those key human rights concerns are and how far we're going to take that. It also includes things like the visa ban on Chinese students and researchers that are involved in so-called military-civil fusion. Who exactly are those researchers? What institutions and fields does that apply to? It's very vague today, and I don't think there's been a clear public reckoning of that, which I think long-term is not in the US interest.
John, thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast. It was such an insightful discussion.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.